Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview that I did with Maren Bush, who is co-starring in Tally's Folly at the Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. It's a very sweet and very delightful story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Show. The Lynn Show is all about you and me and everybody we know and the ways in which our early lives discourage us from being all that we can be and how to reclaim those things that we jettisoned or thought we jettisoned, those things that we learned to pretend we were not. Now, this seems a little convoluted to me when I say it that way, but maybe this will make it clearer. When we are young, quite often, more often than, well, I would certainly like, our families or our culture or our religious organization or our great aunt or our school or our peers have an opinion, a value, a more, a myth about something that we are, that they don't like or think we shouldn't be or think is unpleasant or something. And when we are this, when we are loud and boisterous and excited, or when we're quiet and shy, or when we're assertive and we stand for what we want, or when we cave no matter what anybody says, whatever the quality is, it doesn't actually matter. If it doesn't go down well in one of these systems, we will be made aware of this very quickly. There'll be raising of the eyebrows, rolling of the eyes. There'll be actually, you know, words like little boys don't do that and our little girls don't do that. Or there'll be abandonment, just turn around and leave you where you are. And, of course, aside from neglect and embarrassment and chastising and teasing and all the ways that people have of letting us know that what we did was not okay, there's also abuse. In any case, we understand very quickly that this quality, whichever it is, and it could be anything, is going to bring us a consequence that we don't want. And because children are extremely flexible, we are able, without too much effort, to first pretend that we don't have that, act as though that's not true of us, and over time simply to forget that we ever had it. How do I know this? Well, as a psychotherapist in practice for, I don't know, in excess of 30 years certainly, I have seen over and over and over again clients coming wanting to be able to do something they can't do, or stop doing something that they don't seem to be able to stop doing, and believing that they need something they don't have. To learn something, to develop something, to create something, to something. And over again I have found that that thing that they want, they already have it. But they forgot. They are, to use the psychotherapeutic term, in denial. Their unconscious took that quality and buried it so that they did not have to run the risk of demonstrating that quality and calling down upon themselves the consequence that that quality always created for them. And as I have said numerous times, if you've been listening, the irony is that later in life, it is quite often, certainly it is for the people who come to see me, precisely the quality we had to deny that would make all the difference for us as adults, that would change our lives, that would make our lives more comfortable, make us more comfortable. With some qualities, it's really easy to see. If I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again because it makes the point. A woman came to me in her mid-40s, describing a life in which she had sacrificed and sacrificed and sacrificed and sacrificed, and just whatever anybody wanted is what she wanted. She couldn't even think about what she wanted. She told me she didn't want anything, and she didn't exactly know why she was so exhausted and so angry. Well, of course, she did want things, but she'd forgotten how to want. She'd forgotten how to know what she wanted. She'd lost the connection between her wants and herself. So we worked on it and worked on it and worked on it, and finally she remembered an event from her childhood. She was maybe 3, maybe 4, and her mommy took her to a birthday party of another little child. And in the middle of the room, there were all these presents, and everybody who came to the party was going to get a present on this child's birthday. And they gave out numbers so that you would choose your present in the order that the number that you got. And this little girl got number 1. And so she was the first one to choose, and she ran over and reached for the largest present. And her mother said, "Don't do that. It's not nice to take the largest present." And that may very well have been the last time she really knew what she wanted. She worked very diligently, although she didn't remember much of it, to suppress any sense of wanting. Because the shame of that moment, of her mother's chastising of her in front of everyone, she could still feel it. When she described the situation to me, her cheeks burned, and she was visibly upset. So, she learned wanting brings embarrassment, pain, suffering, ugh, ugh. And she finally became able to stop wanting. So, the Lynn Show is all about this idea that there may very well be something, a quality, that you have denied. And maybe it's even something that you need. Because, of course, it's not rocket science. This woman needed to reconnect with her capacity to want, to begin the process, which, of course, she did, of weaning herself from focusing on what everybody else wanted and ignoring her own, not only wants at this point, but needs. Her need for rest, her need to lose some weight, her need to stand up for herself at work, her need to not be a... I've forgotten the word. Not to simply cave to whatever anyone else wanted without even asking herself what she wanted. So I'm going to give you the exercise, one of the first exercises that I gave her and give other people who have this problem. I quite often say that you can't simply go from I don't know what I want to I always know what I want. It's just not possible. And when you've had an experience like this young woman, whenever you get in touch with a want, you're going to get back whatever it was that discouraged you. So in this woman's case, when she was able to surface a want to know something that she wanted, she felt sick to her stomach. The embarrassment came back. So you can't go from this place where you have so well trained yourself not to want to, oh, okay, I see, I can want now. So a kind of beginning exercise I like to give is to remember that it's not important to know what you want in the beginning. It's useful to make arbitrary choices. It's too hard to figure out what you want, so you make arbitrary choices, because the act of making a choice begins to change the way you feel about your ability to want. Simply the act of making a choice. So that if someone asks you, well, you want to go to lunch? What do you want to have? You don't say, you take the following words out of your vocabulary. I don't care, whatever you want, it's all the same to me, it's okay. What do you think? What do you want? You take those words out of your vocabulary. And when anybody asks you where you want to go for a meal, you say, salads, Chinese food, Indian food. It doesn't matter what you say. It isn't important that it is what you want. What's important is that you make a choice, that you say something. And then when you go, if it turns out you didn't really want a salad, you'll learn something about that. You'll learn that you really wanted Indian food, or the other way around. So if somebody says, want to go to the movies, and you say either yes or no, not I don't care, what do you want to do, it doesn't matter to me, thank you very much, I don't care, right? No. Yes or no. What do you want to see? An arbitrary choice. Everything is a choice as often as you can. For people like my client, if this is a problem for you, it's very, very, very difficult to do what I just said. I said it as though it was easy, but it isn't. So if you find yourself struggling with it, which is to say that you hear yourself saying, oh, I don't care, or what do you want, or any of that, you hear it, pay attention. Just notice how difficult it is. And if at all you are able to make an arbitrary choice, congratulate yourself with a big hooray, because it's really, really hard. So, if this is an issue for you and you want to talk about it, you want to ask me some questions about it, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. thelynnshow.com. And there's a icon there to click on to email me. You can email me, and I will email you back. if you're thinking about going into therapy, I do all of my work on the phone these days. And you can email me again at thelynnshow.com and say that you're curious about phone therapy. There's an article on my website called Therapy on the Go. You could read that, or you could just email me and we could talk about it. Also on my website are all the interviews I have done for this show, including the one I'm about to play. And this is an interview with the lovely and delightful and talented Marin Bush, who is currently co-starring in Tally's Folly at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida, and it will be playing for another couple of weeks. So if you are in Sarasota or nearby, or you're going to be visiting Florida and you want a really delightful evening in the theater, take yourself to FST and see Tally's Folly. You will not be sorry. It's really wonderful. It's charming, it's touching, it's moving, it's uplifting, which for me is a very big deal these days. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and Marin is definitely one of these, and I will let you tell, I will let her tell you her story. So here is Marin Bush. So here I am in the ladies' dressing room with Marin Bush, who is here in Sarasota, Florida, at Florida Studio Theater in Tally's Folly. And I understand, although I haven't read it, that she received a wonderful review, which I know she completely deserves because I did see it. And you really are wonderful.
Thank you.
You are wonderful. It's a great performance.
Mm, thanks.
So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, well, there may be other arts, but you clearly are making your life and, to some extent, your living with the art of acting,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yes.
Yes, good, okay. So I only ask one question, and that is, can you pinpoint where the very earliest moment in your life when either you thought you'd like to be an actor or you had an experience that that would one day lead you to acting? It may not have. You know, you said something funny, everybody laughed, and you really liked it, or, you know, right? So however early, the earliest you can remember, you're shaking your head, so I'm assuming you have some memory.
Yeah,
tell me.
I was really little when the movie Annie came out,
mm-hmm.
and for some reason, that musical just hooked me. I fell in love with the character of Little Orphan Annie, and I fell in love with the music.
Okay,
and
a real little, 5, 8?
4 or 5, I think. Mm-hmm. And my parents had the record that I had them play till it didn't play anymore. And I had a little stuffed doll of Annie. And then a couple years later, small town where I'm from in Kansas, right across the street, they were doing a community theater production of the musical Annie.
Yeah.
And they were showing it for 2 nights. And I had a fever the first night, so I couldn't see it. And the second night, I still had this fever, but my parents let me go see the first act. And then took me home and put me to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But at that stage, I was hooked with the story and the songs. And
so did you learn the songs? Did you sing along?
Yeah, mm-hmm. To the point that I'm from a very small town, Sterling, Kansas. It's 2,000 people. And I had a birthday that summer, and I invited the actress that played Annie to my birthday party and clung to her at this pool party because I thought
really?
She was so cool.
Ah.
Yeah, so funny. She was a real champ to show up.
How old was she?
She must have been in high school, I'm guessing.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. She was
so
a real trooper.
Really, and you were her first groupie.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
she probably got a kick out of it.
Yeah, I think she did. This little obsessed kid.
Right. Maybe that's the moment in her life that told her that, you know, yeah. You know, maybe this is a good thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
okay, so we have you now, obsessed with Annie, yeah. and you can sing along, and mm-hmm. your parents think it's cute because they allow you to do all this stuff, right?
Okay, they think it's cute, maybe borderline annoying, but cute.
Yes, right. But they take you when you have a fever, and they invite mm-hmm. the girl, right,
exactly.
to your birthday party. So,
exactly.
So they're indulging you in this,
they
right?
They certainly are.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so then what happens next?
Well, and then fast forward to when I was in third grade, when I was 8, my parents made my sister and myself audition for the community theater production of Oliver because they needed little kids to play the orphans.
Is your sister older or younger?
She's 3 years older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
She's also an actress, mm-hmm. actually. And so we auditioned, and I remember it was terrible. Audition. I didn't know what I was doing. We had to sing a song from the show and go up and act, and I just remember I didn't know what to do with my hands. I had a lot of, fists on my hips.
It's very cute. Maren is reliving this, and I'm making these awkward movies that are very, very cute. Okay, so this wasn't... So what happened?
Well, they needed bodies, so I was cast.
Oh, and your sister.
Kidding. And we were both cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with it. It was a great experience because, again, this community theater was literally right across the street from my house in Kansas. So I would have dinner and run over to rehearsal, and it was this new family.
Yes.
And I fell in love with the other actors and the story and the songs again, and it was just it was so fun to be a part of that very specific community.
Yeah.
And that's what I fell in love with.
Yeah. What made your parents suggest that you two go over an audition?
They really wanted us to be involved with everything, and it was such a small town that we could. So in high school, I was in tennis, and then band, and choir, and debate, and drama.
So it wasn't that they particularly thought that you would be an actor, any more than they thought you'd be a tennis star.
Exactly, right. Exactly. It was the sort of thing where I think we were going to be spending more time at home that summer, less traveling, and so they wanted us to get involved.
Activity.
Exactly.
Yes, the well-rounded child. Right.
Exactly.
Okay, so... In junior high school, if you had it, or high school, mm-hmm. Were you in plays?
Mm-hmm.
Or,
yeah. We didn't have it in junior high, but in high school, I was involved with every production somehow, whether mm-hmm. I worked backstage or whether I was on stage performing. It was my niche.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember, see, when you say that, that's sort of the answer to my question, but maybe not. Do you remember if you were thinking, I'd like to do this for my life, or that didn't happen then?
It did happen then. I think I didn't really know how that would be possible. I didn't really have someone I knew that had done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't have an example of someone who had done that. But I remember writing my freshman year of high school, we did a time capsule thing where I wrote about what my life would be like 20 or 30 years from
really?
Then.
Yeah. Wow.
And I remember saying that I wanted to be an actress, and worked in a regional town like Seattle or something.
So that was as big as you could imagine.
That's
it, right?
As big as I could think of.
But you could think of doing it.
Yeah.
Even still then, as a freshman in high school, what, 13?
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh, exactly.
Okay. All right. So then you spent a lot of time in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Doing what you could do.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, good.
And doing every other activity that the high school had to offer.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, well-rounded girl.
Very,
yeah,
very
right.
well-rounded girl.
Right. Because I'm assuming your sister did the same
we did.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so then you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And
I moved to Minnesota, where I went to St. Olaf College for my undergrad. It's just a small liberal arts college just out of the Twin Cities, about 3,000 people. Most people know it because Rose from the Golden Girls went there. There are times now when I'll go into auditions and someone will look on my resume, St. Olaf! That's the only reference I know for it.
It's very funny.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It is funny.
Yeah. It's kind of a random place to go, but I knew I wanted to go to a liberal arts school out of the state, primarily north of Kansas. And for whatever reason, I ended up there. It was just a good feeling that
okay.
I had when I visited.
And what did you major in?
Theater.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to audition?
No. It was a BA program. It wasn't a BFA.
Ah.
So when I was taking theater classes, I was also taking religion classes and history classes and Spanish, and I got a very well-rounded education.
Yet again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And in addition to doing plays there, I also sang in the choir, which is a world-renowned choir there at St. Olaf.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and little by little, I was able to start kind of honing in on just kind of paring down to just being an actor there. I also got opportunities of directing, that sort of thing.
So are you saying that, when you say paring down to just being an actor, are you saying that there were moments when you thought there might be something else you would do, or you had to convince your family that this was what it was, or?
I think it was more convincing my family and ultimately convincing myself that I needed to focus just on this. So by the time my senior year of college rolled around, I wasn't singing in the choir anymore. Which was kind of a faux pas at that school, in a way.
Because the choir was a big deal.
It was, yeah, it was quite popular.
So that it was an offense to the, right?
I don't know if it was an offense, but it was odd. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, people who could get into the choir
yeah,
didn't leave.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, so that's an interesting point,
mm-hmm.
because it suggests that there was something of a price to pay for the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit.
So you're beginning already to get it that this career might include some sacrifice.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no.
Right? Yeah, right. I
exactly
see you smiling,
right.
So you're
yeah.
right, right.
Exactly.
And that you were willing to make it.
Right.
That this was this was your choice, this was what you wanted, and if it meant that you had to lose something else, give up something else,
mm-hmm.
Pay the price of someone else's judgment,
mm-hmm.
that you would do it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's really important because you can't actually not have a career as an actor
right.
unless you can do that.
Exactly.
Right.
And there was something that I recognized as well of that I couldn't allow all of my time to be exerted all these other places. I had to kind of focus and
yeah.
hone in and give myself just the time to just kind of live at the theater building. So
yeah.
that's what I did.
Yeah, because it's a distraction,
right.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And even then, young as you were, we only have just so much time and so much energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you made this choice in a pretty powerful way, it seems to me.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given an opportunity to direct my senior year.
How did that happen?
They, at St. Olaf, every year they'll give a senior a main stage production, and they're small black box, but it's part of the season, so you're supported with costumes and with a set designer, that sort of thing. And so I proposed this play, and it got accepted. And
what
so
play?
It was The Shape of Things by Neil LaBute.
Oh, God.
it had just come out. It was actually, we didn't know if we'd get the rights or not, but it's set on a liberal arts college campus, and it was kind of perfect for St. Olaf.
Tell me about it.
It's about this woman, this young master student, Evelyn, and she basically uses her boyfriend as an art project. So she transforms him, essentially. And it's a very cruel...
I've never seen anything or read anything of his that was other than cruel.
Yeah. He really delves into that. If I was to direct something out, it would really not be
But
that.
It's an interesting choice. I mean,
yeah.
You don't seem... I mean, I don't know how to say this. You seem more gentle than that. So it's an interesting choice. Do you remember what it was that drew you?
There was something, and I can't articulate it now because I can't remember the play as well as I'd like to, but there was something within the play, within these characters, that just screamed St. Olaf to me. That the three kind of, there is a four-character play. The one is pretty manipulative and tries to get what she wants, all under the name of art, and uses this person in a pretty cruel manner, in my opinion, all under the umbrella of art. But there was something with the other three characters that were kind of clueless in what they said and kind of were trying to fit into this other box of what they should do and how they should be. And that's kind of how I saw St. Olaf a little bit. And in some ways, I chose the play not because I supported the character Evelyn's, you know, art project by the end of it, but in some ways I kind of wanted to shake St. Olaf up.
Yes, I got it. Yeah. I got it. How interesting. They were manipulatable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
yeah.
Good kids.
Oh, I
Lutheran
love it.
Right.
You
know,
right.
Mostly Minnesota or the Midwest.
Right, who were victimizable.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Or just impressionable.
Well,
wanted to do good in the world and...
Naive. Yes. And so the play makes the point that naivete and innocence can be dangerous.
Absolutely.
And
I think that's absolutely
And you liked
part
that.
Of it.
I mean, you liked that point. Not you don't think you like that, but that you liked making that point.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It was for the students of St. Olaf.
Yeah, I got it. So this is an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it suggests that you had bigger fish to fry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know mm-hmm. what I don't know if I'm making this clear, right?
No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right.
And, well, so that's really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Do you write?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think about it a lot. And there are stories that I want to tell, but it's not my forte.
Do you think that you can't do it? Is that what you think, that you're not good enough at it?
No,
or
it's
not a skill? Or?
It's not that I can't. It's just that I think that there are so many good playwrights. That there are so many good playwrights out there.
Yes. The sky is falling.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. So, so we have, what we have here is a pretty young woman who comes from a pretty... safe and innocent childhood,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Who goes to a pretty safe and innocent school.
Yeah, sure.
And still has this, do you know where you got that? This idea of wanting to shake things up, of wanting to make the point, of wanting to reflect back to people what they might be in danger of?
I'd have to point to my teachers. I had an amazing teacher in high school, Betsy Dutton, who seemed to just get theater and get storytelling in a way that I don't know anyone else in Kansas gets. So I would point to her. I would also point to two teachers at St. Olaf, Donna Friedman and Gary Gisselman. And Gary was my directing teacher, and he came in and basically, you know, said to choose stories for your audience. And why are you telling this story?
And why are you telling this
story?
Yeah,
and ask kind of the bigger philosophical questions. And that's probably what spawned it.
Okay, so then you get out of school,
mm-hmm.
and what happens?
I moved to Minneapolis, so I made the big trek, 40 miles north. and started auditioning, and started...
In why Minneapolis?
It was close. Mm-hmm. And it was a good regional city.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you had said in your freshman time capsule.
Exactly, that I'd move to a regional city and mm-hmm. be a regional actor.
Right.
And within 3 years of moving there, I was working at the one of the best regional theaters in the country, the Guthrie Theater,
mm-hmm.
And was on their radar and working there fairly consistently. And Minneapolis was a great town. I kind of attribute it to... That's where I feel like I learned how to act, because I was given some great roles. There was one production that I did in a warehouse in the middle of nowhere, and it was this amazing play, an amazing role, and just I had the opportunity of working,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't matter what reviews said, and it didn't matter who came to see it necessarily, it was just...
It's the work.
It was the work.
Yeah.
And I was young, so I'd get up and wait tables in the morning and go to rehearsals at night,
mm-hmm.
and it was a good time.
You were alive.
Mm-hmm. And in one of these productions, the casting director from the Guthrie saw me, and I had an end that way, and so I feel very fortunate that I started working with actors that had made their lives working at the Guthrie and made their lives working in the Twin Cities and had chosen that life and had chosen families and a home.
Right.
To
a certain other kinds of
in New York,
right.
For example.
Other kinds of success.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. And it was just the opportunity I had to watch these people work in rehearsals and that I got to see how these people created amazing characters from nothing that was on the page, you know, that was just, it was wonderful for me. I really feel like I still have a community there in a way. So I spent 3 years in Minneapolis, and I wasn't totally content there. I feel like I had defined myself as somewhat of an up-and-coming actress in the Twin Cities, and I was on the Guthrie's radar, but I still wanted more, and I knew I had some more learning to do in terms of the craft. And so I auditioned for graduate school and got into UCSD's program, University of California, San Diego, in La Jolla.
Now, there's a leap.
There's a big leap.
Oh, my God.
From freezing right. Minnesota yes. to the beaches of San Diego.
That's right. That's right. And we're not in regional heaven anymore.
No.
Dorothy.
Exactly. Although La Jolla has, or San Diego has.
Yeah, it does, but it's know. But it's a walk to L.A.,
yeah,
you know.
It certainly is.
Right.
It certainly is.
So, tell me.
So then I spent 3 years in La Jolla training and playing great roles, and I really feel like I was able to be selfish and hone my craft.
Yeah.
And I feel like there I really found a way to work. I feel like I really found my process.
Yeah, you found yourself, your own access to the work, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I almost feel like there was more personal growth in San Diego than there was, not that there's one more than the other, but I also recognize that there was a lot of personal growth, just me as a person.
How old were you?
I got there when I was 25. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pretty formative years.
Well, yeah, but also far enough away from childhood to allow, if a person's going to do it, to allow for the beginning of asking the questions you can't ask when you're younger.
Exactly.
You know, which is what I think you're saying.
Yeah. And it was also far enough away from my undergrad experience as well that I had some time to just be out in the world and work. And
yeah, you could think of yourself as a grown-up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not just
even though you were in school.
Exactly.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that was important for me. I think that buffer of a few years was really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way you used it, certainly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, someone else might not have
right.
used it that way.
Yeah.
So, but again, this suggests a kind of seriousness that the, you know, the choosing of the Neil LaBute play also suggests, you know, kind of, I don't know, interest in philosophical, psychological questions, issues. Am I making a mistake here?
No, I think you're right. There was something in terms of choosing the MFA road that I was making a commitment to this.
Yeah.
And a commitment to myself and also kind of a statement to the world in a way.
Yes.
Of, no, this is what I'm doing.
Right. And it has significance.
It does.
Right. I mean, I think that's what I was looking for. That you, this is what I'm hearing, so you know, and I don't have to be right, so you
right.
could tell me that I'm wrong. But that that the whole idea of being significant, of living a significant life, of being serious about your life, about your work, about who you are, that is as important to you as it is to be a good actor. Is that?
No, exactly. There's an element of integrity behind it.
Yes, there it is. Right. The whole use of the word, right? Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Great, great. And so you did. You gave yourself an opportunity, time out of time, space out of space, right?
Exactly.
A little cocoon place to do that work.
Exactly.
It's great.
Yeah.
And congratulations to you and how lucky you were.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
I do feel incredibly lucky. It's an amazing program. And I spent 3 years with unbelievable actors and teachers, and I will forever be grateful.
Yeah, well, you gave it to yourself. I mean, you can be grateful, but you
yeah.
you know, you did, you really chose it yourself. So, okay, so you get out, you're pushing 30, you're 28 or something, right?
Almost 30. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was an interesting time to go to graduate school because I feel like I was very castable when I got into school.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was still an ingenue at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I can't still play those roles.
I was just going to say,
right?
You can still play ingenue.
Yeah.
If you want.
Yes,
right.
But it's interesting to be in New York and look around, and there are actually 18-year-olds that are auditioning for 18-year-old parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a different game. I feel like right now I'm kind of stuck in between ingenue and leading lady a little bit, but I'm
mm-hmm.
kind of straddling both of those worlds.
Yeah.
But I got out of school. I moved to New York. And
oh.
Another leap.
Yeah.
Another leap. Before I left, however, I got my yoga teaching certificate.
Oh.
Which was
we're both
great.
Sitting.
Yeah.
Right.
Which was a practical skill. I knew after living in Minneapolis that I could go wait tables, but I knew how exhausting that was, and I wanted to find a slightly more sustainable,
mm-hmm. right.
Enjoyable money job.
Yeah.
So I moved to New York, and I've been living there for 2 years
mm-hmm.
now, and it's been tough, honestly. I thought leaving San Diego that, I've been a working actor before. I lived
right.
in Minneapolis. I know the drill. I know the game.
It's not the game.
It's completely different.
Right.
It's completely different. I mean, just to even getting an apartment, it's completely different.
Right. Right.
So it was a really tough transition, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody? Did you know anyone in New York?
Yeah, I knew quite a few people.
Oh,
my
that's
sister
good.
Was
oh.
there for
mm-hmm.
one. She is a working actress in New York, Kristen Bush, and I had a bunch of friends and fellow UCSD alumni there. But it was, it was a hard transition.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting my bearings and getting my footing, I feel like, in terms of financially. And
the culture is all different, too, from any place that you'd been before.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Right.
I was also, I had an incident in my neighborhood in Brooklyn a couple months into living there that was, I think, kind of a big setback, more than I realize. I was mugged and attacked, actually.
Were you hurt?
I was. And, but I'm strong. I've come from, like, strong stock, like,
mm-hmm.
strong
right.
lineage of women especially. And, you know, I recognize that it was an issue, and I, you know, have worked through it. But I think that there was a time that it was almost kind of like this cloud over me in a way in terms of career stuff, but also just personally, you know, that, like, that stuff just wasn't totally happening. And little things would pop up here and there. Like, I did a couple of plays at La Mama, you know, off Broadway
mm-hmm.
theater company, and I did something for the History Channel, and I was able to get an agent. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
so good things happening, but not movement, really, in terms of real personal growth, I feel like.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the good and the bad news. You had a pretty easy ride.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
all along, every place you went embraced you, you embraced it,
mm-hmm.
it was not hard
mm-hmm.
for you,
mm-hmm.
right? So, of course, that's the good news. Everybody wants to have that.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, it doesn't prepare you for the struggle when it doesn't go that easily.
Exactly.
And especially when something really bad happens.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to find a whole new way to integrate that.
Mm-hmm.
Without letting it stop you.
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
And you didn't really have a lot of practice
mm-mm.
at that.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's true. So that's been challenging, you know, to, as you said, integrate into my life.
Yeah, right. Well, to find a place to put it
mm-hmm.
that at the very least doesn't damage you
mm-hmm.
and maybe even you can use,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can find a way to make it valuable for you. Mm. This is a lot to ask, mm-hmm. but still, it's if you can do that,
right?
You know, I know.
And then due time.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a challenge for
yeah,
sure.
It is.
I was interested when you said that, you know, that you're between the rock of ingenue and the
uh-huh.
the not hard place of leading lady.
Yeah.
That Tally is perfect for you.
Thank you.
I mean, you are perfect for it, but it is. I mean, it's. I mean, you are her in. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What are you thinking?
No, when I read the script, it's funny. I had a big trip to Europe planned this summer, and I have tickets booked, and I have relatives in Norway. I had a whole game plan of where I was going to stay, and I was going to travel with a friend in Portugal before that. And this audition came through, and it would have conflicted with the trips, of mm-hmm. course.
Yes, right.
But there's an old saying that, as an actor, if you ever want to get work, book a trip out of town. So I read the play, and I just thought, oh, I'm perfect for this.
Yes.
And this is, you know, she's from a small town.
Oh, yeah, she is you.
Right. It's true.
Right.
And it's something that I don't have to, that part, I don't have to research.
No.
And so it was just a natural fit, and of course I got... You know, not of course, but I got cast.
You got cast, yes, of course you did.
Well,
not only that, but even up to and including that bad thing that happened to you.
Right, exactly.
You could use all of it.
Exactly.
Right. It's a little gift to you.
I guess, in a backwards way, yes.
Well, you know, that's what I meant when I said, you know, that you can find ways to use it, and you must have used it in the...
You know, I don't know that I think about that. I don't think about that.
Oh, okay.
Honestly.
Then,
yeah.
Okay.
I think it's too.
It's all right.
Too soon. Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right. I'm not sure that you ever have to.
Right.
So, Tally is running how long?
It's running until August 26th.
And then, are you going back to New York?
Yes, I am. I am. With a brief stop in Kansas to see my family.
How are they about all of everybody turning, you know, becoming an actor? I mean, that can't be what they had in mind.
Not at all. I my parents are amazingly supportive. Mm-hmm. Yes, they had two daughters, and we both became actors.
Right.
My
right.
sister just closed a play yesterday that ran for a long time at the Roundabout. So, and
well,
two working actors, The Common Pursuit.
Mm.
So. Yeah, so they're supportive, but of course I think that they would love for us to have homes.
Yeah, to settle down.
Yes, and to have family and to have some sort of security in that sense.
Yes.
But I know that they're happy when we're happy.
Yeah. The theme of the show is self-knowledge and the capacity of people to know who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my belief that most people are in denial for significant aspects of who they are, but that people who make their living or their life with an art, it has to be who they really are, because it's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really would do it mm-hmm. if it wasn't congruent to them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's hard. It's mm-hmm. hard. You pay. It's what I was saying earlier about you learning to sacrifice. There are things that you give up to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So is there, do you have a plan? Do you have a goal? Do you have a wish list? Do you have?
Oh, sure. There are roles I want to play. There are things I'd like to accomplish by a certain age. And I keep that pretty close.
That's fine. That's fine. I was thinking when I was asking, what are you talking about? All right. So the other questions, I asked two other questions. One, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask
mm-hmm.
you?
Mm-hmm. Well, something that you just said made me think of one summer in college. I spent my summer as a backpacking guide in Colorado. My family has a cabin in Colorado, and the outdoors and nature is very important to me, especially the mountains. And it was interesting because on one level I was really fulfilled and in nature all summer long and hiking my legs off, but on the other side of it, I felt like I had lost part of my identity, the fact that I wasn't performing, mm-hmm. the fact that I wasn't acting. And I was kind of the goofball and the clown of the group. And I would make people laugh. So I guess I kind of got some of the performance out that way, but I really missed being on stage.
Yeah.
And I think that there was something that was very informative of that summer of, you know, these were my two loves, nature and also acting, and I've chosen yeah. to live in New York City.
That's
and
where we don't have much
no.
after Central Park, it's
exactly.
all over, right?
And then right now I live a block and a half away from Central Park, so I consider myself lucky.
Yes.
But no, there was a time when I feel like there was kind of an active decision of, okay, I'm going to be an actor.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm most myself.
Yes, and in a way, you're answering the next question or the last question, mm-hmm. which is, having devoted a life to this work, mm-hmm. what would you like to say about it?
I don't know. I feel like I'm still really young in it. I feel mm-hmm. like I'm still finding my footing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get to come to the theater every night and warm up my body and voice and go on stage and perform, especially a role like Sally Tally, nothing gives me greater joy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sacrifice along with it. The fact that I don't live in Colorado or Seattle, for that matter, the fact that you know, I've given up other opportunities to choose what I do is, it makes it worth it ultimately when I take a bow and come off stage and feel really good at just about who I am and what I do and the fact that I just feel really lucky.
It's a great place to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
That was lovely.
As I said, the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art is because in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are. Not everyone knows at the age of 4 or 5, although I must say quite a few do. So Maren Bush is one of the lucky ones. She knew from the moment she sat in that theater watching the movie of Annie that this was something that spoke to her, that there was something about this that lightened her, brightened her, excited her, moved her. And the picture of her clinging to the girl who had played Annie in her community theater production, as though somehow that thing could rub off on Maren. And her parents encouraging her daughters to experience everything. Tennis, swimming, debate, to do well in school, in the hope of creating well-rounded adults. A worthy goal, I think. And, of course, as Maren said, they did not expect to wind up with two actresses. But maybe if they had looked at little Maren's face when she was on the stage in Oliver, they would have known that there was no way that that wasn't going to happen, that there was no going back from what she had discovered. What she had discovered was that she was an actor. She says that she gave backpacking. She gave the country. She gave that life one last shot when she was in her mid to late 20s. Took a break, experienced with something else that had brought her joy, happiness, delight, involvement. But she missed who she was. She missed her connection to acting. And this is at the what I hope to get when I interview people like Maren. The conviction, I know who I am. And I know what I need to do for myself, even though I know that there are sacrifices attached to it. when I have the experience, when I get off that stage and I know that I have done it right, I've done it well, I have given it myself, whatever sacrifice is worth it. So, if there is a quality that you have been denying, a part of you that you have been cheated out of, if you recover it, first of all, it's not that easy. It's not so simple as to say, oh yes, there it is, that quality, let me surface it, because whatever the good reason you had for resisting it, for denying it, is still there. But there will be a price. And it is the capacity to endure the price that allows us to be all of who we can be. And so if you want to know more about the price that might be extracted, the sacrifice you might be asked to make, you can talk to me by going up on my website, thelinshow.com, click on email me, or if you just want to read the book and get it from that, you can go up to my website, go to the store, order the book, or the workbook, or the audiobook, or if you want to talk to me, just email me and say you'd like to talk to me. The other thing you can get on my website, aside from Marin's interview and all my interviews, is access to Josh Hackney, the indomitable, the significant, the I couldn't do it without Josh Hackney, who is my IT guy, my savior, really. And if you have issues with computers, recording, electronics, any of that stuff, you want Josh. He can even help you over the phone, as I do my practice on the phone. So go to my website, listen to anything up there that you'd like to listen to, email me, talk to me, ask for Josh. As always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Some information you didn't know that you now have, some inspiration that got sort of, I don't know, osmosisly into your heart, some curiosity, something good, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. Boy, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days. Well, I won't I won't slip out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it is